Good evening.
Good evening.
Continuing to study Dogen's Buddha Nature. I recently remembered a Dokusan that I had with Harada Tangen Roshi at Bukokuji, where I practiced in Japan, through translation, because he didn't really speak any English. I don't remember exactly the whole context, but I remember this part of the conversation is, he asked me, why do you practice? Why do you practice the Buddha Dharma? And I said, because I'm suffering, because it seems to be this great way to relieve the discontent of human life. And he said something like, no, that's wrong. and I thought again, I thought, no, really, that is kind of how I usually think of it when I think of it. If I have to come up with a reason, you know, why I practice so fully and completely, because we just see like the layers and layers of discontent based on human delusion. And Zen practice is his way to cut through delusion and be free. So I'm like, no, really, I think that is why. And we kind of went back and forth that way for a little while. And then I maybe said something like, I give up, tell me why. Why do I practice? And he said, Bussho, Buddha nature. Which I remember it partly because at the time it really struck me. It completely turned it opposite, right? I was thinking, I'm practicing, you know, in order to like work with and get over this stuff. Kind of a negative view of practice. One that's often is presented by our tradition. But this turned it to a completely different, like, positive light. It's not because of all these problems that you're practicing. It's it's because your Buddha nature is making you practice. Your practice is a natural expression of your Buddha nature, whether you know it or not. We're receiving our practice from Buddha nature. I think Suzuki Roshi once said something like, it's wisdom which is seeking wisdom. So sometimes we might look at our practice as seeking wisdom, trying to understand how things are. But where does that come from? From wisdom. It's the true Buddha wisdom, we could call Buddha nature, is what's giving rise to seeking to find itself. You know, like riding a horse, looking for the horse, wearing a hat, looking for our hat. Buddha nature is like, kind of like that. So last week we talked about kind of Indian sutra background of Buddha nature. And if you missed that class and are interested, you can listen online. There's a very rich tradition of Mahayana Buddhist sutras that teach Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature, the heart of the Thus Come One, is another name for Buddha nature. So Dogen bases his teaching on these Mahayana sutras, and he goes beyond the sutras at the same time. So, diving into this long fascicle, Shakyamuni Buddha said in the Nirvana Sutra, the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the Sutra of the Great Cessation, complete Great Cessation, very long, elaborate sutra, which you can read in English. He said, all sentient beings, without exception, have Buddha nature. The Tathagata abides forever without change. Tathagata is the Thus Come One, name of the Buddha. So now Dogen's going to comment on these two sentences of the sutra for a while and turn them in his own way. But first he's just going to praise the Buddha, saying, this is the lion's roar of our great teacher, the Buddha, teaching Dharma. It's actually in the Parinirvana Sutra. It's a chapter called Lion's Roar Bodhisattva. So I think he's probably maybe playing with this lion. It's the lion's roar, which is a name for like the Buddha's teaching, but it's also the teaching of and conversation of the Buddha with lion's roar Bodhisattva. Actually, one footnote says, I think it's chapter 27, but if you look at the English translation by Yamamoto, which you can easily find on the web of this huge Mahaparinirvana Sutra, it's actually chapter 33, if you want to refer to it. And you can find that phrase near the beginning of chapter 33. All beings without exception have Buddha nature. And maybe we can come back to the sutra a little bit as we go on too. It's the lion's roar of our great teacher, the Buddha. It's also the head tops of all Buddhas and ancestors. One translation says, the brains of all Buddhas and ancestors. The pupils, the eye pupils of all Buddhas and ancestors' eyes. Commitment to its study has continued for 2,190 years until now. In a direct, undeviating, lineal descent of exactly 50 generations until my late teacher, priest Tiantong Rujing. It's continued uninterrupted for 28 successive generations in India and 23 successive generations in China. The Buddhas and ancestors in the 10 directions of the universe have all steadily maintained it. Dogen always opens his Shobogenzo essays with this grand kind of celebration, saying that this is really the heart of the matter. And he loves the lineage of Buddhas and ancestors, so he always will mention this is what's actually being transmitted by the Buddhas and ancestors, in this case, Buddha nature. What is the essence of the world-honored ones, the Buddha's words? All sentient beings, without exception, have Buddha nature. It is his utterance of the Dharma teaching. Utterance is that phrase Dogen likes to use. Dotoku means like complete expression. It's his utterance of the Dharma teaching. What is it that thus comes? Or literally says, it's his turning the Dharma wheel, expressing the teaching. What is it that thus comes? Which is from a Zen story that Dogen likes to quote a lot. Anybody know the story that could recite it? Or want to try? Okay, I'll tell you again. And because this is just a great story. You know, he's just referring to the sentence, but I think it's one of a lot, like the heart stories of our Zen tradition and understanding. So it's from the early days of Zen. Nan Yue, a practitioner, goes to the sixth ancestor, Hui Nong. And Hui Nong says, as they often do when people arrive, where are you from? And he says, I'm from Mount Tsung. And Hui Nong says, what is it that thus comes? What is it that thus comes? In the straightforward sense of, well, what is this right here before me now that's just come from Mount Tsung? but also thus, emo in Japanese also means suchness, coming from the ineffable, inconceivable way things are. What is it that comes each moment from thusness? Big question, and he couldn't answer, and said that he kind of worked on this question for 8 years and finally came back and said, I have the answer. Hui Neng again asked, well, what is it that thus comes? And Nan Yue said, to say it's this misses the mark. Which I think, partly I love this story because after working on this for 8 years, you think you might come up with a whole kind of essay, a whole book explaining what is it that thus comes. But all he answers is, to say it's this, to say it's anything at all misses the mark. Like, I can't really say. But I finally arrived at this conclusion after 8 years. To say it's this misses the mark. And then Hui Neng says, well then, is there no practice and realization? Dogen often talks about practice and realization, which comes from this story. To say anything misses the mark, well then, can we not even talk about practice and realization? Is there nothing at all in the end? Is there no practice and realization of Buddhahood? And Nan Yue says, it's not that there's no practice and realization, it's just that they can't be defiled. It's not that there's no practice and realization, they just can't be defiled. For example, defiled by saying it's this, that practice is this or realization is this. Because that's what he realizes, to say it's this misses the mark. We don't say there's no practice, we don't say there's no realization, but to say it's this defiles it, and it can't be defiled. And Hui Neng says, this non-defilement of practice and realization, we could say, is what all the Buddhas and ancestors protect and maintain. So right at the heart of our teaching, I think this is a wonderful story. See if you can memorize at least the gist of it next time I ask. Nan Yue and the Six Ancestors. That's a good question. In the footnotes of all these Dogen chapters, but I don't think it's one of the cases in the book. I don't think it's in any of the major koan collections. You would know, right?
I don't think it is.
No, I think it actually is in Dogen's 300 case. Mm-hmm. Koan collection. And it's not there because Nan Yue is a predecessor of Linji lineage, so it doesn't show up there. But it, like Andy Ferguson's Book of Ancestors, it's in there. And Dogen, yeah, even though it's the predecessors of the Linji lineage, Dogen brings up this story in this phrase a lot. It's like the ineffable. Like, it's not that there's nothing, but just we have to be really careful not to like fixate on it being some particular way. So here he just throws in, when he's talking about this Parinirvana Sutra teaching, this utterance, all sentient beings without exception have Buddha nature, is the turning of the Dharma wheel of what is it that thus comes. So you could say this teaching is, to say it's this misses the mark also. And it's also this teaching of all beings have Buddha nature is it's not that there's no practice and realization. It's all of that. When you speak of living beings, so Dogen brings up these various terms. Living beings, shujo is the term we usually use. Sentient beings, ujo, which is the phrase that Dogen uses in like when non-sentient beings teach the Dharma, in that classic Zen story. That's this. They use this other term, which means like feeling or emotional beings or animate beings, but pretty much the same thing as sentient beings. All classes of living things or all variety of living beings. So Dogen just every kind of, you know, Chinese phrase that people use for sentient beings. He says, whether you speak of living beings, sentient beings, all classes of living things, or all variety of living beings, it makes no difference. The words entire being mean both sentient beings and all beings. In other words, entire being is Buddha nature. So this is one of the main points he's making in this essay here. And you have to hear a little bit about how the Japanese structure of the sentence is set up. These Chinese characters he's quoting. Isai Shujo means all sentient beings. That's straightforward. And then there's this character is Shitsu U. And then Busho, Buddha nature. So all sentient beings, Shitsu U, Buddha nature. So these particular two characters are like this pivotal thing here that where Dogen's doing one of his typical Dogen things of kind of like playing with language in this really creative way. So in the sutra, the usual way of reading, Shitsu is like means something like without exception. Shitsu is like without exception or completely, with nothing missing, entirely. And then particularly U is this pivotal point here, because U, this very common Chinese character, means in a modern dictionary, it can mean either to have or to be, which are very different, right? So it could be read as have Buddha nature or are Buddha nature. And it looks like the usual, typical sutra understanding is all beings have Buddha nature. There's some ineffable reality called Buddha nature that all beings have as their heart, their essential nature that they have is Buddha nature. And the problem with this is it's like, it's a kind of dualistic split. And Dogen's constantly catching all these places where we split experience into duality of subject and object. Even ones that are like maybe really great, and you know, we're not saying Buddha nature is something, but just to say that there's a being that has Buddha nature makes the Buddha nature a little bit separate from the being that has it, right? So Dogen's going to read this and comment on this now as all sentient beings are Buddha nature. And he's going to use this shitsu, meaning like without exception. So instead of without exception have Buddha nature, he's going to say entirely are Buddha nature. Or in their, all sentient beings in their entirety, in their like wholeness, are Buddha nature. Which is, you know, playing with the language without changing the sutra. So he's kind of stretching it a little, maybe. But this is the brilliance of Dogen. That it's like all sentient beings seem like all of us, all these like individual numbered sentient beings. But he's saying all sentient beings, in their whole entirety, as kind of like one being, is Buddha nature. That's a little bit like that shitsu is like without exception can also mean entirely are. So was the original sutra is usually read as all beings without exception have Buddha nature. Dogen's take is all sentient beings in their entirety are Buddha nature, or all sentient beings are completely Buddha nature, or all sentient beings with nothing missing are Buddha nature. Or you could even, you know, say the nothing missing of all sentient beings is Buddha nature. Yes. But we're going to get into that.
Is human nature or the entirety of Patrick is human nature? Is Buddha nature?
I hear it as not limited to one particular person, but he's going to, you know, expand on this in a lot of ways. But I'm hearing it, and this at the beginning here, as all sentient beings, like without differentiation, because partly what he does here is now he's going to talk about this sentient already makes now a split between sentient and non-sentient. So he's like picks up on that little duality, right? Like how are we going to work with this? So and you know this is hard to get in translation. So if you read the different translations, they try to put it into English in different ways, partly because Dogen just messes with grammar completely. So even if you're reading it in Japanese, it's like totally wacky. So in English, it's even wackier. So he uses this, in other words, entire being is Buddha nature. And this translation says, I call the whole integral entity of entire being sentient beings. So this goes to Patrick's question a little bit. And the whole integral entity is, in Japanese, is like, I think it's ishitsu. So like one entirety. I or ichi. One entirety. So like, we could read it as, I call the one entirety of entire being sentient beings. So now we're talking about what it's instead of saying what kind of sentient being has a Buddha nature, it's more like what are sentient beings? And it's kind of like breaking down the distinction between the way things are and particular sentient living beings as opposed to non-sentient. So one entirety of entire being is what we call sentient being. So you could also hear that as this one entire whole, but like kind of removed from all being. This one particular, you could hear it that way too. One particular entirety called a sentient being, in its entire being, is called a sentient being. Does that make sense? I think you can hear this, and it's been translated in various ways. Another translation is, one form of all beings is sentient beings. That's Kaz Tanahashi's. That kind of makes it really simple. Maybe if you took the S off of beings, like one form of all being is sentient beings. So there's all being, and then all being takes these particular forms like sentient beings. In that case, it kind of sounds like it has a whole different sense. One form of all being is sentient beings. Another translation is, one entirety of all entirety is called sentient beings. So you can say, each sentient being is an entire, whole, complete being, lacking nothing, separate from nothing, and then that entire being is within a so-called larger entire being that includes all beings. in an inconceivable way. Right? He's just opening up this whole variety of ways to relate to this simple statement from the sutra that we thought was easy to get a grip on. And now it's like, I think what Dogen's often trying to do is just break down any like limited understanding. So he'll start going one direction and we'll start to kind of like get a handle on it, and then he'll pull that out and go in another direction just so we don't get stuck in any understanding of Buddha nature. And he's going to do this for many pages.
Nishijima's translation is really interesting too, because it says, total existence is the Buddha nature, and the perfect totality of total existence is called living beings.
Ah, that's neat, yeah. So, meaning being, can also mean existence. And this is going to appear again and again throughout this essay. In Buddhist teaching, often u and mu are set up as a pair, meaning like mu means like nothing or there isn't any, and u means there is, like there isn't and there is, and they're a pair, like form and emptiness, right? They're often seen together. And of course, we don't want to like see this as a separate duality. So I think pretty soon here, Dogen's going to say this u is not the u of like this pair of u and mu. The being that we're talking about, being whole, entire being, is not like true existence as opposed to non-existence, because it's empty. So that's something to just keep in mind. U, meaning being, can also mean have, but we're pretty much done with this, with the interpretation of u as have or possess. So generally it means being in this larger sense of inconceivable wholeness of being, but not in some reified way. But then we have to deal with the tradition that often presents being as like existence, like it was translated there, like things truly existing as opposed to mu, where they don't. Yes?
So far, this description of Buddha nature, to me, is one with Dharmakaya. Or at least how I've understood, or thought I understood, Dharmakaya.
How do you understand Dharmakaya?
Well, now is Buddha nature.
Dharmakaya is an interesting term because Dharmakaya is like the reality body of the Buddha. This is Mahayana teaching that on the full realization of Buddhahood, that Buddha includes these three bodies of Nirmanakaya, a manifestation body, which is like Shakyamuni Buddha, looked like this person walking around the earth. And then Dharmakaya is like the Dharma body, the sometimes reality body or truth body, that's like formless and formless, and yet it responds to beings. We hear.
And it's also inclusive of the other bodies.
Yeah, and in a way, kind of like, it manifests the manifestation body and the bliss body, the Sambhogakaya, kind of are manifestations of the formless Dharma body. This is kind of classic Indian Mahayana Buddhism. But it's usually connected with the Dharma. It's a Dharma body of this Bodhisattva's practicing, and then they realize Buddhahood, including the Dharmakaya. So it's in that way, it's like, it's so beyond all our limited conceptions that it's not really connected to that particular Bodhisattva that realized it anymore. And yet, it's kind of like, we could say it's a realization at the end of the path of a particular bodhisattva that realizes the Dharmakaya. So now we're talking about all beings. So that is a little different than the traditional Dharmakaya.
Being as the entirety of being and all beings.
I think, you know, in our Zen understanding of Dharmakaya, because it's completely non-dual, it has to include all beings. But it's not, you know, it's a little different than just non-duality itself. We don't really call it the Dharmakaya. Maybe in Zen it starts to get that way. It starts to become so impersonal, and it's just like reality itself is Dharmakaya. But I'm just bringing up the point that in the tradition it's like this, it's this particular realization of a bodhisattva at the end of their path. You could say that particular bodhisattva, when they become a Buddha, their realization is the non-separation of all beings. But it's more the Dharmakaya is like their realization. Does that make sense? Whereas now we're talking about, we don't know, maybe that's in here too, right? But it seems like Dobin's now implying that, like, he's not even talking about anybody's realization here. And he's actually going to, he gets a little critical about realization later on this page. You know? Because we're just saying all beings in their entirety already, whether anybody realizes it or not, that is Buddha nature. So we're at... I call the whole integral entity of entire being, quotes, sentient beings. And that it's emphasizing this name sentient being. It's just this provisional name that refers to the whole integral entity of all being. Yes?
Yes, I'm wondering if this is a gentle suggestion that all beings are in some way sentient. I don't know if that would be a fair...
yeah, it's kind of interesting there that, like, is Dogen just trying to say, like, well, let's include everything here and call it sentient beings because that's what the sutra says? Or is it a gentle suggestion that everything is sentient, but which we could hear in this kind of mystical, magical way that maybe rocks have some kind of sentience? But we could also hear this question, this investigation of, are all beings, non-sentient beings, how are they related to sentience? And I talked about this a little last week, just briefly, in that sense that when we experience a rock, that's like, if that's an experience of a sentient being. And like, we don't really know if there's rocks outside the experience of a sentient being. So it's not exactly that the rock is sentient and sees us back, but it's more like any rocks that we know of in this universe, if we know of them, we know of them as a sentient being. So in that way, all things are cannot exist apart from sentience. So, you know, I don't know if Dogen's thinking quite that way, but that's also a way to relate to this whole Zen conversation about non-sentient beings teaching the Dharma. You know, what is, you know, does it really mean that, like, rocks are talking, or does it mean that, like, any rocks or sentient or non-sentient things that we think of that way are thought of by us as sentient beings? There aren't any rocks apart from sentient beings. And, you know, or if there were, we would never know about it. Just at the very time when things are thus, both inside and outside of sentient beings are, as such, the entire being of Buddha nature. So just when things are such or thus, which is again playing with just the color wheel things, when things are such as he just said, but also when things are such as they are, when they're emo, when they're ineffably ungraspable, this is such in Buddha Dharma, when things are such, which they are, right? Things are such as they are. And when, just at the very time, this very time, when things are such, both inside and outside of sentient beings are, as such, the entire being of Buddha nature. Inside and outside, everything in between. Entire being is not only the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow directly transmitted. It says from Bodhidharma to his disciples, but in the text it just says, it assumes that we know that this is referring to Bodhidharma. It just says the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow directly transmitted or simply, singly transmitted from Bodhidharma to his disciples, for you attain my skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. So this is referring to the Zen story that Bodhidharma, at the time of his retirement, called his four disciples together and said, express your understanding now. And without going into, you can read the story in the footnotes. One of the disciples, by the way, is Song Chir, our woman ancestor, Song Chir. And one of them is Hueka. And so they all say the wonderful Zen responses. And with each one of them, Bodhidharma says, you've attained my skin, you've attained my flesh, you've attained my bones, you've attained my marrow. And Dogen, in his usual way, when he says, well, people hear that as like, the marrow is deeper than the skin. But Dogen has a whole essay called Coming from the West, the Ancestor Coming from the West, I think, where he talks about skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are not like better and worse. They're, each one is an equal, full expression. So just at the very time when all things are thus, all, you know, entire being, Buddha nature, entire being is not only the skin, flesh, bones, and marrow directly transmitted from Bodhidharma to his disciples, for you attain my skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. So I think what you could say here, he's saying this Buddha nature, entire being, is not just this like rare transmission of Bodhidharma's dharma, but it's actually you, all of you, all beings, attain my Buddha's skin, flesh, bones, and marrow right now. Yeah, so this is like an all-inclusive attainment of the entire being of Buddha nature right now, whether we like it or not, or whether we understand it or not. This is where he's going. You must understand that the being that the Buddha nature makes entire being is not the being, the U, of being and non-being, of U and Mu. So this is what I mentioned previously. This being, the U we're talking about here, is not the U of U and Mu. It's not the being of existence and non-existence. It's not like falling into this one-sided camp. Entire being is a Buddha's words, a Buddha's tongue, the pupils of a Buddha ancestor's eyes, the nose holes or nostrils of a patched robe monk. These are just these Zen sayings Dogen likes to use a lot. Yeah. I think nostrils is a nice one. It refers to all these things, you know. Any great thing he's talking about, he'll say, this itself is the nostrils of a patro monk. And it's just this weird image, right? But it's like you could, well, maybe two interpretations. One is that of like, it's the breath, it's the life-sustaining, most basic life-sustaining realm is our nostrils. It's where we take in life. But it's also the nostrils. Here's three interpretations. And a second one is that the nostrils like join the inside and outside in, you know, the self and the world are constantly like meeting at inconceivably and intimately through the breath passing in and out of this body. And the third interpretation would be like the nose holes, like the like a pierced nose of where they put the ring through an ox's nose to get it to go to work. So like the patro monks are like pierce their own. Maybe it's more commonly they say this is piercing the noses. Maybe it's different characters than the nostrils, but in that sense it's like the patro monks want training, so they put a ring in their nose and let the Buddha like drag them around through the fields of Dharma. Nor does the term entire being, shitsu, mean emergent being. Another translation is embryonic being, something that's like kind of coming to be, or original being, which would mean like it's always originally here and it doesn't come to be. That's another duality. It doesn't mean something that's coming into being, and it doesn't mean originally and primordially always already here. It doesn't fall into that dichotomy. Or mysterious being, like some wondrous, ineffable something that we just leave it at that. Or anything of the like, much less conditioned being or false being. And conditioned being sounds pretty good, but I think we maybe could see this as any idea we have about causality and how things come to be through these particular conditions. It's not that kind of conditioned being. It's dependent co-arising is inconceivable beyond our ideas of it, and not false or illusory being. It has nothing to do with such things as mind and object. The mind and the object that the mind perceives, substance and form, or like nature, like the essence of something and the characteristics of that essence, all these dualities that are kind of classic Buddhist teachings. It's nothing to do with any of them. Because it's like this, the self and the surrounding environment of sentient beings, entire being, is not in the least involved in the waxing influences of karma, is not bred by illusory causation or false cause and effect, falsely understood, limited linear cause and effect. It does not come into being naturally, like spontaneously, and it's not practiced or realized through miraculous powers. Were sentient beings, entire being, contingent on the power of karma or on causes or on coming into being naturally, then the realization of all saints and the enlightenment of all Buddhas and the eye pupils of all Buddhas and ancestors also would be produced in these ways. And they are not. So there are all these nice explanations that would be really nice if any of them Dogen would agree to, but he doesn't. That, and it's good to just know these teachings too, that the realization of the Buddhas doesn't come from their karmic conditioning. You could say, we talked about karma last Wednesday, right? you could say that karmic conditioning does actually set up like the conditions for practice. Karma does determine our practice path, actually. But the realization is not karmically produced. In fact, it's not even caused by anything at all. Enlightenment of all Buddhas is not caused. That's the common understanding in the tradition. And it's not also, it doesn't come into being naturally. It means it's not like, it just spontaneously, for no particular reason, suddenly we're enlightened. We might like to think like that. But it's not like that either. The entire world is completely free of all objective dust. Or, you know, dust is used as this, is this extra stuff added to reality. And it's just as a metaphor. The extra stuff that we add to reality is basically objectivity, or like duality, projecting an external objective world outside ourself. So he's saying the entire world is truly is free from all objective dust. The dusty belief of objects separate from the subject. Right here and now, there is no second person. Exclamation point. Same thing. That's because we are un... Oh, so here's this. This is a hard one. This sentence is a dynamic one. This is because we are unaware that the root source of our illusion is severed and are busily engaged and widely ranging karmic consciousness, in parentheses, inseparable from Buddha nature, never ceases. So I'll read this one again. This is just this one particular take on Dogen's difficult sentence. First, Dogen's saying, there's no objective dust, there's no second person, there's no one outside ourselves. This is because we are unaware that the root source of our illusion is severed. The root source of our illusion is severed, but we're unaware of that and are busily engaged in a widely ranging karmic consciousness never ceases. And the translator is editing, this karmic consciousness is, of course, inseparable from Buddha nature. So one way to hear this is unaware, in a good sense of unaware, where because that would, if we think, oh, my karmic consciousness is now severed, we've just made it into some objective dust. And he's saying there's no second person because we're unaware that the root source of our illusion is severed. If we were aware of that, that would create a second person. That's one understanding. Can you follow that? Dogen's is talking about non-duality here, right? There, right here and now, there is no second person. There's no objective experience. And he's saying, that's because there is no objectivity, because we are, luckily, unaware that the root of our illusion has been severed beginninglessly. In other words, the root of our illusion of duality never existed in the first place. But if we are aware of that as some objective truth, then we make it into like a second person. We make non-duality into like something, some dusty external idea. It's pretty obscure, and you might have to like read that kind of thing over and over to sort of like see where he might be coming from. This is the thing about Dogen, is like every sentence, when you really start to look into it, is like making a extremely subtle point and can be seen in various ways and and is open to interpretation too. So here's another version of this sentence. So right now, right here and now, there's no second person. Cut through the original person beyond knowing. That's more like an instruction instead of how things are. There's no second person. So right now, cut through the original person beyond knowing. Karmic consciousness continues, but without karmic mind. That's Kaz Ta-Nehisi's. Which is kind of maybe a little stretch, but it's playable here. Cut through the original person beyond knowing, and which is maybe just a fancy Zen way of saying drop all dualistic thought. Then karmic consciousness can continue, but without this underlying karmic mind. It's just like the workings of cause and effect as karmic consciousness can just play out. So Karl Bielfeld's translation is, the root source is directly cut, but people have not noticed. The busy, busy karmic consciousness, when will it rest? So that's a little bit like implying that like the problem is that we haven't noticed. So you could make it either way. And the footnotes and commentaries do make it either way. It's open to interpretation. You could either say knowing is a little bit of a problem, but also not knowing could be seen as the problem. Not understanding that the root of our delusion has been severed from the beginning. In other words, the root of our delusion is dualistic thought. Without understanding that dualistic thought is an illusion, there is no such thing as dualistic thought, actually. Without realizing that, then karmic consciousness just rolls on, busy, busy. When will it rest? So, I understand this is even in the text problem for the translators. So I suggest we continue. If you didn't fully get that, but what that sentence was doing. This is not being, so he's talking about the being here. Again, we're clarifying what is meant by this u, this being, that whole being. This is not being that's bred by illusory causation or false imaginary causation, because, quote, nothing throughout the whole world has ever been concealed, unquote, which was a Zen saying that Dogen is fond of bringing up these sayings as appropriate. So it's not bred by our imaginary version of causation that plays out from the past into the present. He's saying because, just like, drop all these ideas, nothing in the world has ever been hidden. I think Dogen, isn't that what the Tenzo says in the instructions to the cook, to Dogen? Is that how it works? Dogen's asking about Dharma. Okay. Do you remember that story?
I'm not sure remembering how the story goes, but the concluding remark by the master, not Dogen, the trained master, is, in the whole world it is never hidden.
Yeah. It's a great Zen saying to post on your refrigerator. Nothing in the world is ever hidden. Everything, and this is definitely the sense of the Buddha nature that Dogen's talking about. It's not a hidden, obscured Buddha nature. It's fully revealed every moment. It's impossible to turn away from it. Nothing throughout the whole world has ever been concealed. To say nothing throughout the whole world has ever been concealed certainly does not mean that the world full of being is nothing but being. It's so hard on us. Mm-hmm. So I hear this as the second, so to say, repeat this again, to say nothing throughout the whole world has ever been concealed certainly does not mean that the world full of being is nothing but being. That's how I hear it, is that the second being is like existence. Nothing has ever been concealed doesn't mean that the being we're talking about is like this true existence, and that the nothing that's been concealed that we see, it really exists as inherent being. I think that's what he's saying. That's how I would understand it. Certainly doesn't mean that. Even though nothing's hidden, it doesn't mean that this entire being truly exists. Yeah, that's a little interpretation. The idea that the entire world and everything in it are my personal possessions is a false non-Buddhist teaching, as you might imagine. Or another translation would be, the idea that the entire world and everything in it are self-being, that's literally what it says, are self-being. So is the being that we're talking about a self-being, like my self-being? Even in this, you know, these teachings where we are like, well, the rock that I'm seeing is, since it's my perceived rock, it's kind of like myself's rock, right? You see a different rock than me. But if we think that rock that image of the rock is this personal possession of my mind, that's like getting into like, my mind is as a fixed self.
Well, that's kind of referring to mind only, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying not to use that word.
Okay. Way to go.
But yeah, in that tradition, it wouldn't say that everything is mine. It sometimes might sound that way, mind only, right? The whole world is mine. And then, you know, loosely speaking, we could say that, but it's not really mine.
It looks when it says self-existence instead of self-being.
Oh, yeah. Self-existence. So, the idea of the entire world and everything in it are self-existence. Ah, yeah. Which could also mean, like, exist in and of themselves. Like, that things have a self. We don't mean that either. The svabhava of things doesn't exist. Yeah, it could be actually where he's going to. It's not original, timeless being, because it fills the past right on up through the present. So it's not timeless, unchanging, original being, because it fills the past right up through the present. It's active, dynamic, appearing right here and now. This is something we might get into more here, because I think part of Dogen's writing this whole essay is based on this term, based on his wanting to correct this, what he sees as this false understanding of Buddha nature that's called Hongaku. In Tendai school and these other schools of Buddhism were around in Dogen's time, meaning like original primordial awakening, that also implying that Buddha nature is always here, everything's it, and therefore, since it's originally present and always the case, it and doesn't have anything to do with practice and realization, then there's no reason for practice and realization. So, and it's just a little divergence here, because I think this is an important point we could talk about more as this class goes on. There was that teaching, and it's a beautiful non-dual teaching, right? Original awakening, all beings are originally awake and complete Buddha. Not just have Buddha nature even, or not just our Buddha nature, but they're completely realized Buddhas. It's like as non-dual as you can get. But this Tendai school, and basically all the Buddhism in Japan that believe this, the practice got totally decadent because nothing matters, right? It's like no practice is any better than any other practice. And precepts or not precepts, you know, it's all exactly the same. It's like non-duality fallen into like nihilism. And with lots of kind of scriptural and basis and teachings backing it up, things evolved more and more that way. And I think we can find movements like this in America too. Extreme non-duality that's kind of, you know, true non-duality doesn't fall into nihilism because it doesn't fall into ooh or moo. It includes being, it includes precepts, it includes practice, and includes realization. But in Dogen's time, there were like, you know, these, the Mount Hiei monks had like armies that would like attack other temples with armed weapons and stuff like this. And they could back it up like this. And there's an interesting book, if you're interested in this topic. There's a lot of books, but there's one called Pruning the Bodhi Tree that some of us studied at Green Gulch for a while. That's about a modern movement called Critical Buddhism. That's modern meaning like in the last century in Japan. Basically, Buddhist scholars being really critical of this Hongaku, this original awakening, and also critical of all Buddha nature and Tathagata Garbha teachings because they're so closely linked. This beautiful teaching of that Buddha nature is here with us always can easily be misused. It's a radical teaching. And this book explores the this modern movement called Critical Buddhism, basically critical of all the Buddha nature teachings and original enlightenment and basically going saying that these were not Buddhist teachings, and it, almost going back to like the original teachings of dependent co-arising as the source, and saying this doesn't accord with dependent co-arising. But just one thing that they mention is the effect in the world in Japan. This actually seems to be the case. You'd think that all beings, all entire being is Buddha nature. All beings have Buddha nature. Let's go with that way that they would usually hear it. All beings equally have Buddha nature would undermine any kind of discrimination, right? And would, like, different castes and different parts of society are all equalized by Buddha nature. That's the way it seems to me, like, that would be the most obvious way to understand it. But apparently, things went reverse in Japan, and they used this very teaching as a discriminatory teaching by basically saying that, the poor, homeless, whatever, are equally manifesting Buddha nature, so there's no reason to help them. So it undermined, like, any kind of bodhisattva beneficial activity because Buddha nature is pervading everything, good and bad, so there's no reason to help. Isn't that interesting? I thought, how could it, when I first heard like Buddha nature teachings, these people are really criticizing because they promote discrimination. I'm like, what? But somehow people were able to do that kind of discrimination.
It's called
Pruning the Bodhi Tree. It's a bunch of essays and rebuttals. Like there's the first essay in the book is called Why They Say That Zen Is Not Buddhism. Because Zen is kind of based on a lot of these teachings. And then the kind of rebuttal essay is, you know, why Tathagata Garbha is like the heart of the Buddha's teaching. It's like not only is it like not non-Buddhist teaching, but it's like the very essential point of Buddhist teaching. So people have widely ranging views, and it's interesting to see their arguments because they really work them out quite well. But it's kind of a scholarly movement, but they bring it into politics, actually, too. And bring all this up partly because Dogen was writing this in this kind of environment where things had gotten really corrupt due to this Hongaku original awakening teachings. So that's partly why he's using this term original being, or how does he say it? It's not original timeless being. That's the same hon of Hongaku. It's not original being because it fills the past right up to the present. It's not some abstract original being. It's right here now. It's not emergent being or this embryonic coming to be being because it does not receive even a particle of dust, or it does not emit even a particle of dust. So this is the other side, we might say. Well, it's emerging and changing, but it's not like you can add even a speck of dust to it. So it's not like our usual idea of things changing and being added to. You can't add anything extra. In this present moment, and nothing's changing. It's like this teaching of the Dharma position that we've talked about previously here. It's like full, complete expression right now that fully includes everything, but it's just an independent expression at the same time. It doesn't emit a speck of dust. Like, you can't add anything to it. It's fully complete. It fully includes everything. Nothing's lacking, nothing's extra. Even a speck of dust can't be subtracted or added. Therefore, it's not something that's gradually emerging. See where he's going with that? It's not separate individual beings because it's an all-inclusive whole. So that's where we might hear that it's this particular being. But here he's saying it's not separate individual beings because it's an inclusive, all-inclusive whole. It's not beginningless being because what is this that thus comes? So it's not beginningless because what is it that thus, when Nanyue arrived at the sixth ancestor, what is it that thus comes right now? Not like, what was your original being before there was any time? It's like, what is it right now that comes, that arrives right here? It's not being that appears at a certain time because everyday mind is the way. Each argument he's answering with a Zen phrase. I think the subtlety here that you wouldn't get unless you know the Chinese is that everyday mind is the way, which is a classic Zen phrase, is every day, actually, the character is continuous mind is the way. And continuous mind colloquially means like our everyday mind. I think everyday mind's a better translation. That's the meaning, is like ordinary mind also. Ordinary mind is the way. Every day may be a little closer to the original because it means every single day. But literally means it's the character that actually is used for like permanence or continuous. But it doesn't really mean permanent mind in this colloquial phrase. But it may be that Dogen's playing with this. He's saying it's not being that appears at a certain time because continuous mind is the way. Or everyday mind is the way. Constant, maybe that would be another one. Constant mind is the way. You must know with certainty that within entire being it is impossible, even with the greatest swiftness, to encounter sentient beings. So this is a little bit like Patrick's question back at the beginning of like, are we talking about individual beings? So here he's really emphasizing that within this entire being, no matter how quick we try to like quickly meet someone, we can't meet another being because there's no other being. There's no second person. There's nothing outside of this whole integral being. He's talking about there's no individuals. And then, you know, I say stuff like, however quick you try to do it, like outsmart reality or something. Quick, meet them. I think the key thing here is he's playing with, you know, encounter or meet. You don't really encounter or meet something else. Even like Nagarjuna's logic is like, if you look really carefully, two things never meet. Two things can never meet. Because if they're two things, and now it's not two things that met, it's one thing now. Right? That's kind of like a very rough way of talking about it. But if you examine kind of the logic of meeting, you can't find meeting. It conventionally appears, of course, all the continuously, but ultimately speaking, you can't find meeting or encountering. Understood in this way, entire being is in itself completely and totally emancipated suchness. Or Satsuraku, Dogen uses as dropping off. So and suchness is actually, in this case, passing through the body. So literally it's more like entire being is in itself completely and totally dropping off and passing through the body. They're just these images, you know, that are like, when I hear these over and over, all these different images, it's not about exactly figuring it out, I think. They're just, you know, as you sit here, to me those images have some function, right? We're sitting here, what is this total being that we're talking about? Well, this total being is like dropping or sloughing off itself and it's passing through the body, almost like just feeling it. This is kind of like the poetry of Dogen, with these weird phrases. A great many students of Buddhism, when they hear the word Buddha nature, mistake it for the self expounded by the Srenika heresy. You know the Srenika heresy? We talked about this, I know, at least one other time. Actually, Srenika heresy, I think, is taught in the Parinirvana Sutra that this phrase comes from. But maybe it's worth just briefly, I'll just read you Dogen's take on it. This is the fascicle mind itself is Buddha. So we had a sesshin on this fascicle once, and a big part of it is Dogen's critique of the Srenika heresy. Basically, it's like Srenika was this person in the time of Buddha who was one of those outside the way, he says here. And basically, he believes that there's some independent self. That's basically it. But it can be quite subtle and sound pretty good. So this is the Srenika's theory as quoted by Dogen. And see if you think that this sounds kind of like Dogen. But see if you can find something that's a little bit different. He says, the great way lies within this body right now. How it works is easy to know. The soul, I'm not sure what he's translating there. It's called some kind of like spiritual entity, like a soul, discerns pain and pleasure, cold and heat, aching and itching. There's some like, this true self can perceive these experiences. It's not obstructed by things, and it's not concerned with objects. While things come and go, and objects are born and die, the soul exists without changing. It pervades all sentient beings, both ordinary and sacred. Although there are illusions, as soon as an embracing wisdom appears, even for a moment, things disappear and objects perish. The soul, the original nature, alone is clearly permanent. When the body is broken, the soul comes out of it unbroken. It's just like the owner of a house on fire who comes out of it safely. What is luminous is called the nature of an awakened person, a Buddha. This is awakening. Self and other equally possess this nature. Both enlightenment and delusion are connected with it. Whatever things or objects may be, the soul is different from them and is unchanged for eons. The objects that exist right now are real only if the soul abides in them. As these objects arise from the soul, the original nature, they are true reality, but they're not permanent. They exist and disappear. This soul is called a knowing spirit, or a spiritual intelligence. It's also called the true self, the true body. To realize this is described as returning to permanence. After such realization, the soul does not transmigrate in birth and death. It enters the true nature of no birth and death. This is Shranika's theory. And Buddha nature often gets criticized for sounding like Shranika's theory. And I think that's what Dogen's saying here. Buddha nature is this permanent entity that doesn't come and go, and we're born and die, but it isn't born and it doesn't die. And you, even in the sutras, it starts to sound like that. So very subtle, and maybe Dogen's even going beyond sutras in his understanding of Buddha nature. It's not something that comes and goes, but it's not some independent entity that can be grasped in any possible way. It's just that it starts to sound that way.
And is it kind of the thing that in Dogen's words, Shranika says it can be known? So
yeah.
Uses the word know.
Uh-huh.
And whereas we're always talking about
kind of grasping. Yep, that's another good point. Mm-hmm. If, and that is like, you just have to know it. And so Dogen talks about realization, but often by realization he means verifying. Often what gets translated as realization, practice and realization. It's really practice and verification of Buddha nature, you could say, or not too. Verification has a very different sense from knowing something. We might wonder though, what is verification if it's not knowing? But that's a big topic. So yes.
Something that struck me a little strange was the idea of this entity as being the thing that can sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another part of Shranika's theory there, is that it's kind of connected with the just usual conceptual experiences, and it, you know, it itches and it knows objects and so on. So therefore we can deduce also that it's making it's kind of like a dualistic consciousness. So sometimes it sounds like it's this, like it's not a dualistic consciousness, it's something that's deeper than that, it doesn't come and go. And then sometimes it gets start sounding like it does know things dualistically, even ordinary colors and things. So it's like Shranika didn't really like work out exactly, well, what is this thing? It sounds good to combine all that stuff, but if we look more closely, it's like it doesn't quite hold up and match together even as a coherent theory. But I thought it's nice because it sounds pretty good. You know, it's not like a totally deluded thing. Like, I am like the self of the universe, and I can do anything. It's more like, it's just kind of a subtle point. It sounds a lot like some Zen teachers and teachings. So even like Dogen himself, like in this very mind, this mind itself is Buddha. That's where he brings it up, right? And he's saying, so what is it that this mind itself is Buddha? It's not Shranika's theory. What makes it different? And when you read the whole fascicle, it's not totally clear why it's so different from Shranika's theory, because it's so subtle. Oh, I see. Well, see, where are we at the end of a paragraph?
The end of this Shranika.
Shranika. It's like Shranika, all this small print is so hard to find.
A great many students of Buddhism, when they hear the word Buddha nature,
oh, yeah, okay. Okay. Well, let's stop there. Yeah.
So Jesus part way.
Yeah.
This will be better.
Yeah, it's not the movements of the conscious mind.
Is it possible that Dogen is helping us by just untangling everything and leaving us untangled? That's the way the teaching works.
Yeah.
And it's kind of pulling all this in the absence apart.
Uh-huh.
And,
I think that without reconstructing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's often the usual Zen thing. It's like, take everything away, but don't give you anything in its place, which is, you know, doesn't sound too good to a sentient being, but actually it's the best, right? Because then that's just the freedom of, like, not having to hold anything. And I think he, in a very painstaking way, in this long essay, he's examining all these different sayings about Buddha nature, pulling them apart, investigating them. And in the end, I think we'll see. If in the end we do have a kind of coherent whole where we can say, like, I actually feel like I have a sense of Dogen's version of Buddha nature now. I think we might be able to come to that conclusion by the end. But he's covering every different angle and basically saying what it's not. Mostly saying what it's not in the classic Buddhist tradition, not letting us get a hold of anything. So thanks for bearing with this. It's a hard study, and again, I recommend reading ahead the next little section. I was hoping to maybe cover like a page of these 10 pages each time. We're not quite making it. But all the footnotes, particularly Karl Bielefeld and these Waddell translation, a lot of the topics we talked about today are in those footnotes. And mainly just enjoy Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. That's dropping off and passing through the body all the time. Sometimes we might stop a moment and appreciate it. May all beings open to all-pervading Buddha nature, entire being, whole being. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. Surpassable.